And you asked me to speak about something to do with gender identity. Mm-hmm. Very happy to share some reflections. And also, it can be interactive, or we can make time for any comments or challenges or opinions or whatever. You know, it'd be lovely to hear, because I prefer to work interactively than just kind of discourse into a space, but you know, there are forms and ways out there, so very happy to hear whenever, if there's anything you wish to come in with. But when Santa Chitta asked me to offer some reflections on gender, I just put the word in and just thought, let that bubble away as it does, because I have spent quite a lot of my life reflecting on what this all means. And so it's nice to check in and just see what changes, what shifts. Yeah. And actually, when we were coming home from our picnic today, we were in a supermarket buying popsicles, and a woman beside me at the checkout said, "Oh, that's lovely in pink." Not my face, but my shirt. And I rather fancied that I had a red and white striped shirt on, not a pink one, but I could see her point. But so first she commented on how lovely the pink was, and then she said, "It's back in fashion, you know." And then she moved a little closer, quite conspiratorially, and said, "So now we have permission to wear it again." And probably 20 years ago, I would have felt some shame and some horror at that exchange. It probably wouldn't have happened, because she's probably more my age. And what I felt was her sweet, open connectedness, just this lovely warmth and this this interest in connecting and belonging, and perhaps also her interest in pink as a colour. But you know, it was also loaded with assumptions. That I was a woman, that I was wearing pink, and that we've been always wanting to, and now's our chance again. So what was actually a very old and old-fashioned shirt suddenly it became something else. But I just felt into that, and what was there and what wasn't there around that exchange, because from the earliest age that I can remember, I was resisting being gendered in a way. My mother told me that when I was about 3, we used to go to church, to mass, and a dress had been made for me, and she put this dress on me, and I said, "No, I won't wear that dress." And she said, "No, you must. It's a gift that your grandmother made." I think it's my grandmother. "No, I won't wear that dress. That doesn't work for me." "No, you will wear that dress." And we had a standoff, and you can't come to mass if you don't wear that dress. And I think at 3, coming to mass was more being with family, going on an outing. So I resisted, and so I wasn't allowed to go to mass. There was someone there to look after me at home. And then the second Sunday, same thing. "Okay, we'll put her in this dress now." "No, I'm not wearing that dress." "Yes, you must. It's a gift." "No." So I resisted, and I wasn't allowed to come to mass, and I stayed home. And then the third time, things always happen in threes, and this is actual, the third time, she went to put it on me, and I guess I knew what was coming, and so I said, "Well, all right, just on the condition that I can take it off at the end of Mass." And she said, "All right, that's a deal." So as soon as the priest said, "Go in peace to love and serve the Lord," I took my dress off in church, which at 3 wasn't such a scandal, though. In an Asian country, perhaps it was in Singapore. And so clearly there was something going on at 3, you know, that felt innate. And I sort of have a memory of that. And then growing up with a sense that, are people kidding when they talk about boys and girls? Are they kidding? Because I just had no experience of being gendered. How could you be a gender? It seemed to me, I thought they were kidding. And but never knew. It wasn't that I wanted to be a boy. So girls who don't want to be gendered in those ways get called tomboys or whatever back then. So there were these questions from quite an early age. And then I got to an age where I was walking on my own to a park, probably 11 or 12 years old. And so I'd been all right in that world of just sort of okay, they think there's these genders, that's all right, doesn't bother me. Yeah. Until I was alone in a park and some bigger kids came up to me and said, what are you, a boy or a girl? And suddenly I realised that the non-decision was actually dangerous, because they said, if you don't tell us, we're going to take your clothes off and find out for ourselves. So I learned very quickly that, okay, so there's sex and there's gender, and people think that those belong together and that it's inevitable, and I have no answer to them, but there's a risk in having no answer. So I was fine. I went home, told my siblings, and they all said, right, we're going to get those kids. But that didn't happen, but I felt validated in some way. I probably didn't tell them the reason, because I think one of the elephants in a room around gender, sexuality, and still, even though there's a lot of discourse and proliferation around it, I think shame is the leading subjective experience that keeps systems in place in a lot of forms of identity and cultural regulation. And so I looked and thought about shame and gender and sex and sexuality for quite a long time, until I found myself writing a doctorate about this and really exploring what does it mean to not actually experience yourself as gendered. This was before there were terms like non-binary or, the whole LGBTI kind of community was still very much, there were gays and, well, maybe a few lesbians around. This is sort of 80s in Australia, 90s. There just wasn't enough kind of connected discourse around these things, so there weren't names in the same way. And then coming out in terms of my sexuality, saying to a therapist, well, if I don't identify as a woman, how can I identify as a lesbian, even though I'm attracted to women? I said to her, and she's like, well, look, I totally get your point in the abstract, in the metaphysical, but you live in the world, and if you don't come out, if you don't have that, if people can't meet you, they can't know you, they can't sort of respond to the real in a way. And it really sat with me for quite a while, that very compassionate and very skillful response, I believe. What she was telling me was about how identity can be strategic. And it really helped me. It helped me to come out. But it really helped me to understand how to authentically, or how to honour the real experience of not feeling that I was of this or of that, with the reality of living in a world where we are in relationship and we exchange and we make meaning and we use language to do that. And if I go back to pink, what does pink mean? So for that woman in the shop today, perhaps it meant permission to express a kind of element of herself, it can mean embarrassment, it can mean sunburn. Pink, like all words, they work in a context. They mean and they signify in a context, yeah. And so I think that sort of that inquiry about meaning and denotation and connotation, the use of language, all of that sort of, as I sat with that and read and theorized and worked through all of this and integrated my own coming out, I came to the Buddhist teachings. And I don't think that's an accident, because the Buddhist teachings on no self, and at the same time the ethical framework within which all of that operates, actually spoke more deeply to the inquiry I had than any of the identity politics that were circulating in the 90s. Though, in their renovated form, they have a very powerful and useful function now, those identity politics. So that's just some autobiographical information to provide some context for maybe a reflection that, gender still, people still come in, we come into being, we rise into being on contact, don't we? And so we're not inherently one thing or another.
Yeah.
And yet I don't arise into being as a hippopotamus or an ant or a Indian man. There's a form and it has its limits. It has its containment. And so there's not a complete fiction, and there's not complete control, is there? you know, in how we arise into being and how we represent and see others and receive others and are seen and are received. So language and classifications and categories become really important ways for us to actually mediate our connections with one another. They're often, in my experience, in sort of Buddhist context, they can often be dismissed as irrelevant from an absolutist viewpoint. You know, there's no self, what's your problem? There's no gender, so be happy at the end of the food line because it's not real. you know, the kind of, we can flip according to our perceptions and our needs and our needs for power. We can flip between the absolute and the relative, perhaps unthinkingly. But actually, when it comes to something like our sense of who we are in a world that still really operates out of a binary around sex and gender, to not be aware of the effect that words can have and how they can bring into being and they can also exclude the birthing of, is a risk that's not worth taking, I think. So there's something about the way the discourse is getting a little bit refined, I think, in, say, LGBTI worlds around, you know, non-binary, intersex, transgender, that all the sort of terminology that's becoming more more mainstream in a way, more in exchange, actually allows people to come into being more fully as themselves than they have been able to do because the language wasn't there to do the birthing. And it's not that one precedes the other, but they co-arise and allow something its expression. And when there isn't the language for that or the receptivity for that, there's shame. The shaming goes right to the identity or the form that isn't part of the deal, that isn't part of the binary. And when I was doing my doctoral research, it was at around the time that Judith Butler was writing about gender. Is anyone aware of Judith Butler's work? Gender Trouble was a really good title for one of her first books. So she's a kind of thought leader, a philosopher, an academic who writes about how gender is a kind of performativity. And sometimes that was taken as, oh, it's a performance, so let's put it on. I don't think she meant that, the sense that we're all performing our gender. It's not inherent at one level because the meanings around gender are cultural.
Mm.
Yet it can be felt so deeply, truly as a kind of core in the relational sphere, right? So, you know, whatever you are in that spectrum, cisgender, transgender, non-binary, whatever. And so for me, there's something about, there's a kind of joy I take in actually hearing come into being more and more commonly in mainstream identities that have been shamed or silenced, ignored, not understood, pathologized. And in some Buddhist contexts, there can be a sense of, well, that's just wrong view, you're stuck in identity. Has an energy for me of the kind of shaming qualities. It doesn't have an energy of a kind of something that comes out of a field of awareness. And I suppose what motivates me to say this is that I guess I've had some advocacy experience and continue to around LGBTI rights. And a little while back, I was working, still am actually, on a research committee of a kind of counselling and psychotherapy body in Australia. And we've decided to use a human rights framework for how we articulate certain politics. And we heard that one of our, it's a federation of different counselling organisations, psychotherapy organisations, and we heard that one of them, a Christian one, was some of the members were using reparative therapy, conversion therapy on their clients, which means that they were trying to pray away the gay. And apart from being, it's actually not illegal, but it's understood to be wrong in a thousand ways. there's no evidence for its effectiveness, and in fact the guy who led Exodus, the Exodus Foundation in America, who championed that, came out and apologised. So, you know, this is not something that, PACFA, this organisation, really wanted to have its members practising. And so the research committee were told about this, and we decided, well, we think we need to get a human rights framework around this, and let's write a position statement, because that's what these sort of bodies do. And we wrote a position statement around LGBTIQ people and their LGBTIQ plus people and their families, therapeutic support of, and put some research in there around how conversion therapy is not supportable according to any of the science, any of the practices. And I had to put it to council. It fell upon me to put it to the council. And as I walked up to do this, several people looked at me and it was like, oh, this is going to be a hard day for you. Geez, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes. Look out. You know, and I sort of quivered my way up to the podium and sort of put this thing forward. It was up on a screen and just sort of gave the context and said, so we actually have to vote on this. And we'd written about it for a year, warning members about it, and the only response we'd had was from that same organisation writing very toxic rants about same-sex desire and bestiality and paraphilia and all the kind of pathologies that are in the DSM-5, if any of you know that manual of that pathologises health issues, mental health. So it can be a useful manual and it can be diagnostically useful, but not in this case. It had homosexuality as an illness until the 70s, so that manual's dubious and political too. But the point of this, sharing this with you, is that all we'd had was this kind of reactivity and rejection, and then people going, oh, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes right now. And when I put it to the group of about 100 people, their responses were, what, are you kidding me? That doesn't go far enough. What do you? Yeah, this is good, we need this, but we need more. And so 99% of the people were like, duh, of course, you know. And there were one or two dissenters, you can probably imagine where from. So that got passed, and that's become published, and that's a statement we use. And then when we've had people complain about conversion therapy still going on or something like that, we've been able to use that statement as a tool to not just for activism and support, but to actually regulate practice in the profession. But this was just a few years ago, and people, when I said to people, it's really helpful to have your support, but I wonder why you didn't say anything in the year while we were asking you for your feedback. And they're like, but it's, you know, everyone knows that this stuff's kind of been sorted, this stuff's fine now, we, you know, there's no problem, everyone's accepting lesbian and gays and there's no issue. And so the levels of the assumptions kind of facilitate the flow of shame, the exchange of shame, I think, that can go on. And where shame lands is worth looking at. And I think it's important, not just in terms of sexuality identities, but other issues around race, around class, anything that we arise into being on in terms of identity. So I've started to look at shame in terms of my own practice as well. Sometimes when I work with clients therapeutically, psychotherapeutically, I start to feel shame rising in me. And if I'm aware enough and alert enough, I might think, I wonder if there's something going on over there that's not being heard or met either by me or by some broader field. And if I'm aware of it enough and not lost in that feeling, can bring it to the client, and then usually we can hold something, and it's usually something that the client couldn't hold, and it becomes transferred, you know, it flows through to the therapist. But in other contexts, maybe a monastic context as well, when people speak up about particular issues, or you know, there was the whole 5 points in the UK, they're asked all those 5 points. The shame that silences, for me, that's a starting point. That's a point for investigation, because, you know, if all compound things yield deliverance as essence, then shame itself, we sit with it, if we feel it through, and don't swallow it, don't take it on, maybe even give it back. You know, that sutta that comes to mind for me of the Buddha, I'll have to render it in its spirit rather than its letter, but I think having an argument with an angry Brahmin, the Brahmin projecting anger onto the Buddha, and the Buddha giving an example of a feast, and if you were being fed kind of poisonous food or hateful material, what would you do with it? Would you take it or would you give it back? And the Brahmin says, well, I'd give it back. And the Buddha says, well, I give you back your anger. I won't receive your anger. That kind of idea of giving something back, not in anger, but out of a sense of recognizing where things belong. And so in a gestalt framework, a therapy framework I was trained in, we consider shame a rupture in the field. So in the field, there's some unwritten law, some code, and there's a rupture. Who wears the shame? You know, who wears the shame, and how do you get past that? And in a therapeutic training, the answer to that, or the assumptions around that, are that obviously the person who's embodying whatever it is that can't be spoken of, can't, that the field doesn't yet have the collective maturity or capacity to hold, right? The person who most embodies that is the garbage can for that stuff. And the way to move through that shame is to, it's a rupture in the relational field, is to open up connection again, to reconnect. And it has, in terms of how field energy operates, that capacity to give back tends to lift the collective awareness or energy of the field. I think of the wisdom of that facilitator who's bringing together the reds and the blues, no pinks, but the Democrats and the Republicans, and that... you know, there's a long-term process, but that idea of actually bringing into communication. And one way you do that is to have a language to name what's actually, you know, the elephant in the room, name what it is. So I've reflected and continue to reflect in my own way on what, if I'm feeling shame, what's happening there. There's a certain quality of shame that's beneficial. You know, or hiriotapa, that sense that if we've overstepped a mark in terms of our own values or an agreement we've made, that feeling of shame is a trigger for awareness to reflect and to maybe take action in some way, make amends, seek forgiveness, whatever. There's that kind of healthy shame. And then there's the toxic shame that comes from being a recipient of endless, unexamined, disowned denial or shame around something. So in terms of a practice, it's not mutually exclusive with the politics, the advocacy, whatever we can do to investigate and free up some of these exclusions. But there's something about from a field of present-centered awareness, whatever's arising, in the case of shame, it's a kind of contracting, heavy, hot, can feel different, you know, phenomenologically for various people, but there does seem to be a sense of a closing down that's happening, and a willingness to sit with that without making a story or an identity out of it can be quite... potent and supportive in releasing that flow of passing on repression, passing on denial, keeping a lid on certain energies. So if I think about myself as part of a community, if you like, of LGBTIQA plus whatever people, it, you know, there's a sense of a strategic identity, a willingness to show up in a particular form and express as needed that part of my experience, an unwillingness to be closed off in relation to those elements of experience. But none of it feels in conflict with an ongoing inquiry into who am I, or an ongoing inquiry into this, you know, empty phenomena rolling on. There's a sense of if we're committed to a sense of supporting people's full expression of their being, there's a sense of a willingness to show up, a willingness to see others rather than suspect them. I see a heterosexual, but I suspect a homosexual, that kind of pattern that goes on. I think she might be gay. She could be queer. But we don't do the opposite. We don't say, I think those people over there might be heterosexual. Did you see how they were walking? That pink on the woman, I think, is a dead giveaway. Yeah. We don't do that. But the sense of being able to sort of inhabit our relative reality without losing a deeper knowing that we have, that there isn't a continuous consciousness moving through the world. There's an arise. It's a kind of, for me, a paradox and a bit of a miracle. This arising and a willingness to show up as we are, moment to moment. And that can change. I didn't need to show up as a frustrated sort of 8-year-old with a woman liking my pink top. I never wore a pink top at that age. But as time passes, how we relate to our identities, how we embody, how we shift changes, and actually how they're presented and articulated changes. So we're in this constant process of interaction and relation with meanings, words, subjective experience. It's this sort of, maybe not even this slow, this kind of, you know, electrons and protons, this rapid movement of all of these phenomena rolling on as they will according to conditions, causes and conditions. But we don't get a get out of jail free card. We don't get the spiritual bypass, you know. I have no self. You know, we have forms to fill out. We have passports to, you know, declare ourselves on. We have these forms. And I think something that always stays with me is the idea of receiving others and seeing. I went to a conference a little while back, and in Australia the practice is to have Aboriginal elders come and welcome you to country again and again and again, so that there's an understanding that this is contested land and that these are the custodians of the land. So in public settings this happens, and there were these Aboriginal elders who came to this massive conference, and they did a smudging and they got up on stage. They were together, interestingly. They stood, a few of them together. It wasn't an individual. And one of them gave a greeting in his language. There are about 700 Aboriginal Australian languages, so it's hard to say there's a shared sort of language. And he gave a greeting and then translated into English, and he said, "I see you." And this just struck me like a thunderbolt, and that's never left me, this "I see you." This is a greeting that Aboriginal Australians, at least in his group, use. And I thought right then and there, "And I really don't see you. Yet. I work in the city, I work in these different places, I move in these worlds, and, you know, there's so few, proportionally so few Aboriginal Australians in public life, involved, engaged. Many do live in city centres, and many also in the centre. I've never been to the centre of the country." So there's just this sense of, if this has come down through tens of thousands of years, "I see you." That's a sign to me of how very deeply important it is, at least to Aboriginal Australians, to see someone as they are. And all the more horror and what it must be like for them to not be seen, you know, as custodians of the land, connected to their land, and how important to them language is. Language, land and expression. These are important to Aboriginal Australians because they have the longest ongoing living communities on the planet. And so I trust the wisdom of some of those understandings that have been distilled over time. And it's the same yearnings that I had as a child, that I have as an adult, that we might all have, to see and be seen as we are. And although that changes and shifts as we grow and shift ourselves, gender's described as being fluid, but so is all manner of our experiences are fluid. There might be pretty consistent patterns, but they're still fluid, subject to change, part of the cycle of dependent origination. And yet, again, here we are in these forms, and we have to show up. We come into, arise into being on contact according to causes and conditions in this context now. So I guess when I reflect in this way, I find myself quite comfortable and at ease as a Buddhist practitioner, with a sense both of the experience of there being no inherent, ongoing, continuous self as such, but there also being a responsibility to risk showing up in the forms and the all that goes with that for my identity as a human in this realm. That's what comes to mind when I think about gender.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.